achievement and his success in sobriety, as an attorney, as a real estate developer in Delaware, as a recovery diplomat in his parents' homeland, where he'd once been called, he said, the Bill Wilson of Lithuania. He'd visited alcohol wards all over the country in 1991, just after it declared its independence from the Soviet Union, and left behind a copy of the Big Book translated into Lithuanian. This work in Lithuania was a crucial part of the story Sawyer wanted to tell about himself, in which the upward mobility of his sobriety had been the culmination of a life committed to self-supporting labor. Guarding produce stands overnight as a boy, or working in a steel mill where molten steel poured like quicksilver over the flames. Sobriety allowed Sawyer to keep following the narrative arc he knew he'd been destined for, the story of a made son who'd done right by his mother's dreams, a story that began when his mother took him to the 1933 Century of Progress Exposition in Chicago, and he saw the highways of the future, their impossible swirl and swoop. That day he felt awe, wanted to become someone who built things, someone with power, someone who changed the world. The sobriety story Sawyer told me was the story he'd constructed for himself to live inside of, like a house by the banks of a creek, a story in which he'd worked hard and been rewarded for that hard work, in which that work functioned as penance for drinking away the money his mother had saved for his education or the money his family had needed for the gas bill. In his narrative, industry was the theater of his recovery. Good intentions turned into profit, and sobriety made the alchemy possible. It wasn't until we were parked by the old Seneca site, with the engine killed, that Sawyer told me about the arrests, or the girl he'd fallen for in Baltimore, the one who got away, before he was married, and how he ruined his chances by getting drunk before their first date. It was as if the creek itself, or the memory of the house, had opened something in him, as if we were having our own meeting, right there by the water, surrounded by the ghost walls of a home he'd helped build. We faced the lock house on the canal, with its whitewashed bricks. Summer campers in life jackets gathered by the water in pockets of rustling neon orange. When he wrote poems, Sawyer said, they weren't about his drinking. They were about his sober awe. He was still a boy wondering at the impossible highways of the future, still a man who was shown a bend in a creek, a dirty old fishing hostel, and thought, sure, a bunch of drunks could stay here for a while. Decades after it got torn down, he found himself buckled into a motorized wheelchair by the same creek, telling a stranger what it was like, a stranger 55 years younger, who 55 years after Sawyer got sober, gave her own version of the same moist-eyed apologies for the same stubborn thirst. We tell ourselves stories in order to live, Joan Didion wrote, and at first I took her words as gospel. Stories help us survive. But eventually I realized they were more like an admonition, a suggestion that there was something compromised and shameful about our dependence on their false coherence. When Didion wrote, I began to doubt the premises of all the stories I had ever told myself. I understood her skepticism as an accusation. Trusting stories was naive, a refusal to confront actuality in all its senselessness. But in recovery, I started to believe again that stories could do all the things Didion had taught me to distrust, that they could lend meaningful arcs of cohesion, that they could save us from our lives by letting us construct ourselves. I'd always had faith in doubt, in questioning and undermining, looking for fissures, splitting the seams of tidy resolution to find the complexity teeming underneath. But I started to wonder if sometimes doubt was just an easy alibi, a way to avoid the more precarious state of affirmation, making yourself vulnerable by standing behind something that could be criticized, disproven, or ridiculed. Maybe it was just as much a crutch to doubt stories as to stand behind them. It was so easy to point out gaps without filling them, to duck into the foxhole of ambivalence. Maybe sometimes you just had to accept that the story of your life was a crafted thing, selected, curated, skewed in service of things you could name and probably other things you couldn't. Maybe you could accept all that and still believe it might do you or someone else some good. Recovery reminded me that storytelling was ultimately about community, not self-deception. Recovery didn't say, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live." It said, "We tell others our stories in order to help them live too." When I went looking for the tales of Seneca House, I found that every sobriety story had its own particular veins of redemption. Sawyer crafted the story of his sobriety as a story of accountability, learning to be a responsible father, and manifest destiny. That's why he needed to tell me about how much money he made. Gwen told her story as a tale of necessary humbling. Marcus told his story as a myth of hubris punished, and Shirley narrated sobriety as self-reclamation, finally putting herself first. If Sawyer told a sobriety story about upward mobility, then Gwen, the mother who'd driven her kids over the Potomac River in a blackout, told one whose first chapter hinged on failure. For the first 16 months after she started going to meetings, Gwen kept getting nostalgic and picking up again. She saw a Schlitz ad with a woman at the prow of a sailboat in a long, flowing white dress. "You only go around once in life," the voiceover said. "Go for all the gusto you can." And kept trying to figure out if there was a way she could still live on that sailboat, with her white dress billowing in the wind. Eventually, Gwen got so fed up with AA that she drafted a letter of resignation. The only problem was she didn't know where to send it. She asked her sponsor, who had been around for a while, and she said, "Why don't you just give it to me?" Not long afterward, Gwen heard at a meeting that the old wooden fishing hostel, the one across the creek from her house, was getting turned into a rehab. She could see its creaky old sign from her living room window. She thought, "Holy Toledo!" She had to stay sober now, or else she'd be reminded of her failure every time she watched TV. Her last drink was a single shot of warm vodka at 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. She and her husband had been entertaining all weekend, and she'd been so good. Hadn't drunk a thing. And then once everyone left, she went down to the basement bar and poured herself what she'd been denying herself for 48 hours straight. 44 years after her last shot, on March 7, 1971, I spent the day with Gwen at her retirement community in Maryland, where she told me about hitting bottom while we stood in the cafeteria line for Tuscan flounder, disappointing her kids, filling the vinegar bottle. When she finally showed up at Seneca, it was to offer her services as a counselor. She was a trained social worker, after all. But Craig, the manager, wasn't having it. He knew her from AA and knew she kept relapsing. He said she couldn't be a counselor until she'd been on antabuse for a year, but she could volunteer if she wanted. So that's how Gwen became the hobby lady, teaching residents how to make moccasins, belts, wallets. She came across the bridge every morning with her Gordon setter, Misty. She spent that year on antabuse terrified of relapsing. One time she accidentally swallowed creme de menthe that had been poured on a sundae. She tasted it as the ice cream melted over her tongue. After that, she carried the suspicion that even the pleasures still available to her, even hot fudge sundaes, might get her in trouble. But she also wasn't sure what was left of her without drinking. "If you carve me out," she wondered, "will there be enough here to be a person?" What came after all that humbling? After serving her time as hobby lady, Gwen became a counselor at Seneca and eventually director. She started working there 7 days a week, often 10 hours a day. By this point, at home, her marriage was in trouble. Her husband just wanted to get back the little girl he'd married, he said. But Gwen told him that little girl had never existed. They eventually divorced, and Gwen threw herself into Seneca House work, a new marriage, to replace the old one. After 5 years sober, Gwen reread her own letter of resignation from AA, The woman she'd given it to had kept it for years, just so she could give it back. Gwen had effectively sent her resignation letter to a future version of herself, who was living a sobriety she couldn't have imagined. 4 decades later, Gwen told me she was grateful for her grandchildren, who had offered her a second chance to do the things she hadn't done with her own kids. She'd gotten down on the floor to play with them. She'd given them that. Marcus told his sobriety story as a version of the Icarus legend. He'd flown too close to the sun in 100 Saudi airplanes and then smoked himself skeletal. If drinking and drugging were all about restlessness, flying all over the world, making money, feeling special, then recovery was about giving up the delusion of his own exceptionality. During his first days at Seneca, Marcus could identify with the other residents' cravings, but not with their experiences. He'd lived more. But no one believed he'd traveled to Bombay, to Bangkok, to Manila, to Honolulu, to San Francisco in a month. They'd heard so much bullshit from so many addicts. Marcus's breakthrough happened in a session with a Seneca counselor named Bart, an older black man with a steady government job. These were things Marcus wanted. A decent salary, a resume that demanded respect. Marcus was doing a half-hearted first step in front of the group, and Bart said, "Why don't you get real?" That's when something snapped in Marcus. He got so mad he threw his chair across the room and started to see how much anger he had at his country, at its racism, its hypocrisy, and at himself, too, though he couldn't quite see that yet. He sat on a front porch bench with the house dog, a beagle named Snoopy, thinking, "I made such a mess." His family hadn't been a family where you talked about your feelings. He hadn't talked about his feelings much on the train to Mogadishu, or playing baseball with a crack pipe in White Plains, or in those bleary Bangkok bars. But decades later, by the time I met him at a cafe near DuPont Circle, he'd been talking for years. He'd just come back from a stint working as an election observer in Haiti, where he'd gone to AA meetings in Port-au-Prince, whose slogans were in Creole, though the message was the same: one day at a time. He'd ended up committing much of his professional life to giving other men, the prisoners in his federal rehabilitation program, the tools they needed to speak. Shirley's sobriety story was about reclamation. For much of her adult life, she'd put herself in servitude. To her husband, to their home, to her children, and drank to make it tolerable. Getting sober was about waking up and saying she needed something for herself. At first, she didn't think she'd be able to do 28 days at Seneca, because who would take care of her kids? But one of the Seneca counselors, Madeline, said that Shirley needed to put her sobriety before everything else. Kids, marriage, career. Couldn't her husband take care of their children for once? When Shirley showed up at Seneca in 1973, she was its 269th guest. She spent her first lunch weeping at a long wooden table, eating a cheeseburger while "Keep On Loving You" played on the stereo. A gruff old man brought her a carton of milk and told her everyone cried when they arrived and everyone cried again when they left. Shirley was happier doing housework at Seneca than she had been doing it at home because it was more reciprocal. Everyone else had chores, too, and less like indentured servitude. She cooked for 40 people when the cook relapsed and went AWOL. One time she put Tide in the dishwasher instead of Cascade, then spent the next few hours trying to sweep up all the suds as foam crept all the way into the living room. Shirley was such a good listener that another resident gave her a tourniquet for her bleeding heart. But in group sessions, Madeline pushed her to get honest. "Let's talk about your mother-in-law's crystal," she said. And on Shirley's last day at Seneca, Madeline put her through a marathon session. She got 10 counselors in a room and locked the doors, then said, "Let's see how truthful you can be." When Shirley asked what would happen if she needed to go to the bathroom, Madeline said, "You will not piss away your emotions." Shirley adored Madeline. who eventually became her sponsor, fierce but fully present. "I'm right here, love," she'd say. Before Madeline had become an exhibitionist drunk, running naked in the snow with her husband chasing after her, she'd been a child without parents. She'd grown up in India, orphaned at the age of 10 when her stepfather shot her mother and her mother's lover in a Delhi hotel. Her stepfather had tried to molest Madeline years before that. One day at Seneca, when Madeline and Shirley were walking by the creek, Madeline picked up a branch that had been hit by lightning and pointed to its charred core. "You see that blackness?" she told Shirley. "That's how I felt when things happened to me." To celebrate 3 years together, our first October back in New Haven, Dave and I went out for dinner at the pizza joint with vinyl booths behind our apartment. We ate clams on a white pie and toasted with white birch beer. How special. "I know it's basically the length of a bathroom break in the scale of your relationship," I wrote to a friend who'd been with his wife for a decade. "But for me, 3 years is forever. I'm proud of us." We signed up to collect weekly installments of produce from a farm in Woodbridge, a half hour northwest of us. Torpedo onions, parsley and collards, bok choy, tatsoi, greens I'd never heard of and had no idea what to do with. Signing up for these weekly bundles was like putting a down payment on the life I wanted to be living but wasn't quite. A life in which we happily drank seltzer and followed the recipes that came over email from the farm. Tangy glazed carrots with cranberries, browned butter pasta with tatsoi, chocolate beet cake. Mostly, the greens wilted in our crisper and left little puddles of brown juice at the corners of the plastic drawer. Back in Iowa, Dave and his distances, or the ways I projected these distances onto him, had kept our relationship charged by longing. The fact that I could never fully have him meant I always wanted him. Now that he was more available, I was often gone, leaving our apartment many nights to write at a diner outside of town that stayed open 24 hours a day. It was called the Athenian, with big glass windows and stone siding, and at 2 in the morning it was pretty much empty, just a few cops and a tired graveyard shift waitress. I got curly fries or apple pie and worked on the proposal for my dissertation about writers who had gotten sober. I liked the adrenaline I got from going to the diner late at night, surrounded by desolate strangers. It made sobriety surge with electricity, with late-night caffeine spikes of bitter coffee, and it was often easier to be away from home. Away from Dave, as if I were proving something about independence, proving what I didn't need from him any longer. When I started visiting the archives of writers who had gotten drunk and gotten sober, I was looking for the underbelly of the whiskey and ink mythology, for the blood and sweat and vomit of what their drinking had been, and also for what their sobriety had made possible. Finding their voices in the archives reminded me of being at a meeting, all those savage losses lurking under the ways strangers compose themselves. Every archive had its own rituals. "Leave your bags here, sign your name there, get your key over here, use these folders, use this code, use this room for your conspiracy research, wear these headphones for the scratchy recording of the old Creole songs, buy this postcard of a beat-up kitchen table, write to this widow for permission. Everything depends upon this pencil stub." Every archive held the same imperative of careful touch. Every archive was a shrine to the futile task of preserving a life. Every archive was a siren song coaxing the same intimate, deluded ventriloquism, wanting to speak the truth of someone who couldn't speak. Every archive breathed quietly against the shameless volumes of the past, the lost noise of everything broken and breaking, all that violence crackling under fragile yellowed pages. In a pristine room at Dartmouth, full of cold New Hampshire sunlight, I wanted to refute Charles Jackson's fear of becoming a sapped soul like the other AA folks, not very bright or interesting or anything. But when I went looking for the fruits of his sober creativity, I found a manuscript that bored me. When I went looking for the promise that I wasn't losing myself in recovery, I didn't find the resolution of my fears but their reflection, lurking with its gleaming eyes, waiting me out. Though I was moved by the cardboard box that held his first typescript of the lost weekend, labeled in his scribbled handwriting, original manuscript of the lost weekend, not valuable, but please save. He may have told an AA meeting that writing the lost weekend didn't help him stay sober, but it did console him in the wake of one devastating relapse. It was absolutely honest, syllable for syllable, he wrote to a friend. It was a writer really on the beam, telling nothing but universal truth. When I read Jackson's letters, I stared down the glowing comet trails of my impossible counterfactual desires. What if he'd treated his wife better, fought his ego better, stayed sober longer? My desires lived in an awkward tense, an impossible past perfect. And at night, I went back to the room I was renting in the hills of Vermont from a lesbian couple who lived with their daughters in a bright farmhouse with a Finnish wood-burning stove. Their duck pond was frozen for the season, but their chickens were still laying, and they scrambled fresh eggs for breakfast every morning. The residue of their home, its warmth, lingered with me in the archives as I sifted through letters from Jackson's wife, Rhoda, and imagined the marriage she'd never had. I keep dreaming of what a good and happy marriage could have meant to me, she wrote to her brother-in-law. How different it would be with love. Years later, she told her daughter that Charles was the best thing that had ever happened to her. This was the trick of living, that both feelings could be true at once. At the Center of Alcohol Studies at Rutgers, where Rhoda worked for decades while her husband kept relapsing, early AA newsletters listed loner meetings with only one member. Waldo in Caracas, Alessandro in Colombia, Mildred at the Taj Mahal Hotel in Delhi. One flyer announced a 30th anniversary celebration where Bill W. would make a live appearance. In person, in person, in person. By the time I got to Stepping Stones, Wilson's home in Westchester, New York, a brown barn-style colonial revival, hobbit quaint but oddly large, it had become a pilgrimage site. We always say it's not a successful tour, the director once said, unless at least one person cries. People cried at the big wooden bed where Wilson and his wife Lois read recovery literature to each other every morning. They cried at the artifacts of their daily lives, the can of hairspray, a single bobby pin, and at the kitchen table where Wilson drank gin and pineapple juice while Ebby talked to him about sobriety, and Wilson told himself that his gin would last longer than his friend's preaching. They cried at the little silver stovetop coffee pot perched beneath a wall of mugs, the same pot that had brewed coffee for hundreds of newly sober addicts. My own eyes welled up. But if this place was a house of worship, Bill Wilson wasn't its God. The God was communion itself, the cups of coffee, the possibility of penetrating the ordinary loneliness of being a drunk. In Wilson's archives, on an early manuscript of the Big Book, I saw a line he had crossed out from another man's testimony. At no time did I ever find a place where I could not get liquor when I wanted it. When I wanted it. Had there been a time when he didn't? The words were already implied. Something in me rose to salute Wilson's strike-through. It was like nodding at a meeting. Amen. The evening I left Berryman's archives for the last time, after days spent poring over AA step work covered with coffee stains and cigarette burns, my Uber driver was a man named Kyle who'd recently come back to Minnesota from the West Coast, where he had been working graveyard shifts as a poker dealer in a speakeasy. He had come back to get away from a life that had grown toxic, he told me. Too much drinking, a full-fledged gambling addiction, and because he wanted to reconnect to his core passion, Christian rap. In his teens, he'd been unstoppable, playing churches all over the Midwest, And when things had gotten bad back in California, all Kyle had wanted was to write raps again. But now that he was back, no longer gambling and drinking less, he had writer's block. Just that afternoon, I'd been reading the note from Berryman's analyst. Your creative skills are not so intertwined with your emotional problems. And I asked Kyle if he thought he wrote better from crisis or stability. Kyle thought for a while, then said he wrote from both, though the raps turned out differently. But if he had to choose, he'd choose stability in a heartbeat, even if it meant he never wrote again. For a simple reason. Stability was when he felt closest to God. Just before Halloween, I asked Dave if he thought Iowa had broken something between us that couldn't be fixed. It was easier to construct the sentence like that. Iowa had done it. It's like something has gone numb, I told him. Can't you sense that? Yes, he said simply. I can. I'd been ready to convince him, but it was horrible when he agreed immediately. He told me he'd been trying to explain to a friend what it felt like to hug me when we got home at the end of the day. How stiff. How empty. This made me flinch, imagining all the times we'd hugged and he'd been thinking, this is empty. I'd wanted to believe in intention, intention, intention. Going through the motions, showing up for commitments. All that program language that had given me a rudder when my own instincts seemed totally fucked. But apparently sometimes going through the motions could be just that. Nothing saving. Only hollow. Like hugging a corpse. Whatever was broken, I told him, I wasn't sure we could fix it. When I said that, Dave started crying. This was something I'd never seen him do. A flurry of snow fell beyond our giant picture window, sifting a layer of powdered white onto the bricks of the old corset factory where we'd been drunk, falling in love, 3 years earlier. It was the beginning of the massive early nor'easter they'd call Snowtober. Not for the first time, I accused Dave of thrilling toward my strength and pulling away from my weakness, from those times I'd been needy or dull or low. But for the first time, he agreed. I know that coldness, he said, after a long silence. I'm ashamed of it. In 3 years, he'd never really owned this, and I felt a sudden wash of relief, like an exhalation, that I hadn't been crazy all this time. But it was never because he only wanted the good parts of me, he explained. It was never that he didn't want my sadness. That was just the story I'd written. He hadn't been pulling away from my fear, only the ways I'd blamed him for it. I didn't blame you, I started to say, then thought of all the times I'd cried at him, like a weapon. What I gave was never enough, he continued. It was exhausting. He said there was an ice that ran through him sometimes, a sense of shutting down, and he wanted to fight it. But he'd never been repulsed by my need. Only tired of the ways I constantly forgot how much he'd given me. That first time I'd seen the coldness on his face, the night before my surgery when I said I was scared, had it ever occurred to me, he asked, that he might have been scared too? And honestly, it never had. Had it ever occurred to me, he asked, that the day after we'd first kissed, down in Newport News, canvassing for Obama, that the whole time I'd been waiting for a sign from him, he'd been waiting for a sign from me. It sounds ridiculous, but it stunned me. I'd always assumed his assurance. I'd never seen him like this before, pleading. Could we try? Could we keep trying? We agreed that we could. We would. This was sobriety, I thought, not the clean break, the clear-cut and burn-it-down approach, but something else. This was staying inside the mess and seeing it through. Coming down from all our crying that night, Dave and I watched Blade Runner and I cried some more. Nobody believed the replicant could feel anything, but it turned out he'd been moved by so much. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion, sea beams glittering in the dark. In the morality play I'd written, things had been simple. I suffered and Dave recoiled from my suffering. So many times, I'd told Dave that he hated being around me when I was sad. But I was starting to see that he just hated how I'd accused him of hating being around me when I was sad. I'd convinced myself that the problem between us was about Dave's aversion to my needs, that he was the embodiment of not needing itself, an absence in human form. But perhaps the problem was that I'd translated need so immediately into accusation. Your stone face. When in truth his face was many things. Often kind, often listening, often curious. I just feared the stone face so much I'd started to expect it, to feel him retracting, to feel my own inadequacy as cause, to feel. Emotion was my compulsion and obsession, the organ through which I processed the world, turning it to praise and harm like the liver turns ethyl alcohol to acetaldehyde and acid. I could do better. That evening, we decided to make food for the Occupy protesters camped downtown. This would be the thing we did instead of breaking up, a sign of hope and possibility. We baked sugar cookies that filled our loft with their sweet heat. I imagined how they'd be received, with surprise and gratitude. It was dark by the time we arrived at the green. After someone directed us to the food tent, we set our plate of cookies on a table crowded with brownies, lemon squares dusted with sugar, a blueberry pie with a plastic cover, and a ring Danish from the grocery store. As we left, I heard someone say, "Why does everyone bring cookies? We've got so much fucking dessert here." Contract logic justifies all kinds of labor and makes all kinds of promises. If I do X, I'll get Y. But anyone who lives by contract logic for long enough is eventually betrayed by it. The people in the Occupy tent don't always say what you want them to say. The sober writer doesn't always write a sober epic. The sober writer doesn't always even stay sober. Charles Jackson eventually decided AA had flattened him out and that it worked best for the mindless, that it had doomed him to years of a kind of gray, bleak, empty well-being that made true creative work impossible, consigning him to apathy, spiritlessness, blank sobriety, and a vegetable health. Jackson decided he believed in the Faustian bargain after all, believed in the choice between sobriety and genius. Should I say the hell with it and return to my former indulgence, he wondered, and thus be freed from my healthy prison, free once more from fear, able to function as a writer again. After years of Mobius strip sobriety, in and out, on and off, Jackson finally committed suicide by overdosing on Seconal in 1968. If my obsession with authors who had gotten sober was another version of contract logic, played out with whatever God I was tentatively praying to. If I get sober, you'll show me writers whose sobriety inspired them. It was an obsession that delivered a humbling and partial hope. Which isn't to say I didn't find writers who wrote beautifully from recovery. Wallace, Johnson, Carver. But that the universe responded to my demands the way it often does. Unpredictably, on its own schedule, without the grand drama of either boundless mana or unequivocal refusal. I wanted every recovery story to wear its sobriety like a shimmering, supernatural gown. But sometimes a story is just a thing someone needed to say, or a way someone needed to fail. Contract logic involved its own tyrannical, authorial impulse. I will write the script, and God will make it come true. But sobriety didn't dutifully deliver on its end of the contracts I'd written. It did the opposite, offered relief from my own plotline. The sobriety stories I heard from Seneca House often hinged on overturned scripts and thwarted expectations. Marcus thought he was destined for a reckless expat life abroad, but ended up petting a beagle on a soggy creekside porch. Gwen had been Citizen of the Year before she spent time as the Hobby Lady. Shirley thought she had one life mapped out for herself, a career in journalism and marriage to another journalist. But sobriety delivered something else entirely. A divorce, a cross-country move, years as a single parent. Sobriety wasn't instantaneous wish fulfillment. It was more like tearing off a bandage and reckoning directly with everything she'd been drinking to survive. Shirley almost committed suicide the first time she ever did a fourth step. Her inventory was 96 single-spaced typed pages long, full of all her resentments at her husband and all her ambivalence about being a mother. She was planning to kill herself with carbon monoxide in the Pinto in her garage, and she'd gotten as far as turning the ignition when she thought about her kids coming home from school and finding her body there. So she killed the engine and went inside to call her shrink instead. She ended up in a locked ward for 30 days on suicide watch. That was the real end of her marriage, she told me, her stay at a psychiatric hospital. Lou's pride couldn't stomach it. After they divorced, Shirley moved back to Portland with two kids, no husband, and no job. Her first AA meeting was in a smoky room full of strict old-timers. "We don't hold hands," they said, "and we don't say hi." She attempted suicide once more after the move to Portland, slit her wrists, but survived. So much unfolded after Shirley didn't die. Two more cross-country moves, two children coming of age, one child's gender transition, six AA love affairs, two bouts of cancer. She got a job teaching journalism in Louisiana, spent decades in activism, protesting the Keystone Pipeline, marching with Black Lives Matter, and growing a robust flock of Portland pigeons, other sober women she sponsored. At meetings, she was always the one arguing that you never threw out a newcomer, no matter how drunk he was. You had to find a way to let him stay in the room. 40 years after she got sober, Shirley showed me her Portland. Not backyard beehives and artisanal gelato shops, but the hospital where she'd gotten her mastectomy, the bend in the Willamette River that reminded her of a suicide attempt. She showed me the partially deflated balloons from her most recent sobriety milestones. 35 years, then 40, dangling from her apartment ceiling like hanging plants, and a poster on her office wall, a blow-up of a feature called Cheap and Chic from her daughter Laura's college newspaper that showed Laura wearing clothes she'd gotten from secondhand stores, sassy pedal pushers, and a plush green velvet hat. That Cheap and Chic spread meant something to Shirley, in part because it was a validation of her sober mothering when she'd encouraged her children to learn how to shop for themselves. During my Seneca visits, with Sawyer, Gwen, Marcus, and Shirley, the ghosts of old dramas set up shop in the banality of the present, in living rooms and coffee shops, memories of hair stringy with vomit, nights in jail, crack in White Plains, white lightning in Monrovia, children driven over bridges during blackouts. After Gwen told me about her suicide attempt, we held out our plates of Tuscan flounder for scoops of rice pilaf. Recovery works like this. You bring old traumas into the buffet line. You dump the old coffee grounds and listen to the story of a suicide attempt. It's no diminishment of what was painful and no romanticizing of it either. Only an awareness of everything giving way to something else. This chicken and dumplings. This salad bar. Certain stories might carry the easy lilt of practiced narrative grooves. Madeline's blackened branch and Gwen's moccasin making. Marcus throwing a chair across the room in anger. Sawyer touring drunk wards in Lithuania. Shirley dancing tango in an empty bakery. But just because a story has been crafted for survival, sculpted by memory, polished by repetition, whittled into artifact, doesn't mean it doesn't also hold truth. Years after her second suicide attempt, Shirley met a man in the Portland recovery scene a guy who rode supplies out to the oil rigs, who had slit his wrists too. Whenever he and Shirley ran into each other at meetings, they bumped their wrists together and touched suicide scars. In recovery, certain kinds of difficulty are harder to confess than others. The hardest stories for Shirley to tell, early on, were about her marriage. It wasn't hard to talk about how much she resented her husband, his rages and his self-absorption, but it was hard to talk about how much she'd relished being his sacrificing helpmeet. Shirley had a certain narrative about their life together, about how she'd hated her role in it, and it was harder to admit this other part, the thrill of martyrdom and sacrifice. It took her an even longer time to share what she'd whispered to Laura, her infant daughter, the day of her adoption. "I don't want you. I don't want you. I don't want you." Sometimes the hardest things to confess are the difficulties of sobriety. The story of Shirley's parenting wasn't a simple conversion narrative, that she had been a terrible parent drunk and a better one sober. Her sobriety was hard on her kids, too. They missed her when she was away at rehab. When Shirley asked her daughter to speak at her 14th sobriety anniversary, Laura talked about how she felt Shirley had abandoned her for sobriety. As a girl, Laura had once asked Shirley's sponsor, Madeline, "Why doesn't my mother love me?" And Madeline told her, "Your mother can't love anyone right now." At a 1970 AA convention in Miami, one speaker lamented that an AA member might believe that he must tell an unqualified success story or not speak, that he might think he should not speak about his fear of people, his inability to work or understand all aspects of the program, or the fact that he may frequently behave badly, or that he is unhappy and depressed, even when all these things may be true. But in meetings, I found these weren't the experiences you were expected to excise from sobriety. They were sobriety. The bad behavior and grumpiness as much as the wonder. Sawyer had a piece of framed calligraphy hanging on the wall of his basement. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a history of our personal success stories. It is, rather, a history of our colossal human failures. At one point, Sawyer told me that Gwen had gone through a burnout when she was director of Seneca House. "Let her tell you this, not me," he said. "But we had to send her away to a rehab that they have for burned-out treatment people. They had an intervention on her." When I finally worked up the nerve to ask Gwen about it, we were sitting in the Blue Note, the bar at her retirement home, in the middle of the afternoon when it was utterly empty, and she said the intervention had happened during an incredibly stressful time. She'd been organizing her son's wedding and pulling together the paperwork for Seneca House to get the accreditation it needed for third-party reimbursement from insurance companies. She'd broken down crying. "Once," she said. Then she'd shown up at Seneca to find a circle intervention waiting for her, which, of course, she told me, "I used to teach people how to do." At her staff's request, Gwen ended up at a specialized treatment center in Palm Springs, California. It was recovery for people who had wrung themselves dry trying to recover others. Gwen knew all their exercises. They hung purses and pillows from her outstretched arms. "They burdened you until you could hardly stand up," she said, and then said, "How do you feel?" I thought, I know what you want me to say. It was clear there were certain kinds of vulnerability that Gwen had readily admitted into her narrative. Her fallibility as a mother, her early lapses in sobriety, the necessary humbling of becoming the hobby lady, staying on antabuse until she'd been sober a year, and other kinds of vulnerability her story hadn't fully metabolized. The day when she was the focus of the circle rather than its leader. The day she stood accused of being overwhelmed. But the most useful sobriety stories are the ones that acknowledge how sobriety can bottom out, because they also acknowledge its surprise and depth, that sobriety is fundamentally full of unpredictability, miraculous, harrowing. For me, it wasn't just moving but useful to know that Gwen had hit a wall one day and started crying. Recovery means giving what you need yourself, not what you already possess. Your own fragility isn't a liability, but a gift. You bump suicide scars with a stranger. You don't kick the drunk out of a meeting. You find a way to let him stay in the room. For much of that first autumn back in New Haven, I clung to what my sponsor told me. No big changes in the first year, and stayed in my relationship with Dave. But by clinging to that prohibition, I'd also flipped it into possibility. Once a year had passed, I would have permission. And when I hit a year of continuous sobriety in early December, I told Dave I couldn't do it anymore. Everything between us felt exhausted, brittle, depleted. The hot magma of conflict, with all its heat and surge, had cooled into hardened ridges of resentment, quieter, lunar landscape. The realizations I'd had about what had broken between us had come too late to resuscitate what had already bled out. It was hard to explain the almost in our love, to myself or anyone, how consuming it was, that sense of being almost able to make it work. His mind was the mind I most wanted to ask every question. He'd spread a picnic across the marble of a train station at midnight. He'd told me I should take vitamins so my bones didn't break when he fucked me. He'd read Berryman to me in a humid August kitchen. He was fully alive without drinking. When we were up, we were so fully together in that state of upness. But when I came low, I always believed that I'd betrayed the person he wanted me to be. I loathed this version of myself so much I couldn't believe he didn't loathe her as well. When I told him that I thought we were done, Dave looked so pained. He asked me to take some time to think about it. It seemed cruel to both of us somehow that the thing that made him reach for me was the idea I might finally pull away. I went to stay for a few days with a friend in Brooklyn in her tiny studio on 9th Street, where we binge-watched Rihanna videos. She was falling in love. She was sad in a bathtub. She was smoking 8 cigarettes at once. I cried over greasy hamburgers at the dive joint on her block. While I was there, I got a note from Dave saying he'd found my big book lying on our bed. When he confessed he'd started looking through it, reading notes I'd scribbled in the margins, I felt the sad gratification of symmetry, his desire to know those parts of me that didn't involve him. "You've been examining yourself so fearlessly," he wrote, "in this quiet way I haven't ever really asked about." He quoted a passage in the big book that I'd underlined, "Fear is an evil and corroding thread," and wrote, "I think I feel now something like what you must have felt so often in Iowa." It wasn't just that he was afraid I'd leave him. It was that he had begun to understand the ways fear could rearrange you, could fill you with disarming and overwhelming kinds of longing, to know another person, to gather all their pieces, to read their secret thoughts. When I came back to our apartment, I saw 3 empty nips of liquor in our recycling bin, the kind you'd find in a hotel minibar. He'd been drinking, he said. This was what it looked like when he drank. 3 little bottles. I knew that I wanted him to be happy, but worried that I resented him too much to make him happy. I looked at those 3 empty nips and told him, "I can't." When we had sex that afternoon, it was familiar and domestic. Pulling socks off each other's feet, peeling away long underwear. All the leaves had fallen from the trees and couldn't block the sun any longer. He bent my leg so that my knee jutted in front of the window, winter light gleaming behind. It felt possible to reach for him without reservation now that I knew I was losing him. I watched our limbs tangled, thinking, "I can't believe this is ending." I told myself I was learning to live without drinking so I could become a stronger version of myself, someone who could build a life with him without rotting it with fear. I'd told myself that I was giving up drinking to make our love possible. Now, I was sending myself into another life without either one. 13. Reckoning. At the back of the composition book filled with notes for recovery, his unfinished novel, Berryman left behind a fairy tale called The Hunter in the Forest. He wrote it with his daughter, Martha, and most of it was transcribed in her effortful child's print. In the story, a hunter gets lost in a forest where two bears live, both named Hungry, because they were always hungry every single second. They steal the hunter's food, put his gun in a squirrel hole, and take off his pants. That was a very angry hunter. Then they put him in a cage and lock the door. Though the story never frames it this way, these are the dilemmas of addiction. The bears are hungry every single second. The hunter is lost. The hunter is in a cage. Berryman and his daughter wrote four different endings, three of them in Berryman's cursive. He fixed the lock, got out of the cage, and conquered all the animals. And they said, "There, that's what you do to us. You're lucky we didn't kill you." Moral: be kind to animals and they will be kind to you. He awakened, and they fed him nothing but hay. One ending offered victory. The hunter triumphs over the animals. Another one offered a moral: if you are good to the world, it will be good to you. A third offered disappointment: nothing but hay. Martha wrote the fourth ending in her serious, childish scrawl. She labeled it real ending. The hunter awakened and said, "Well?" This final ending, the real ending, offered the true anticlimax of salvation. The hunter doesn't know what to make of the world he has woken into. Well, after waking up, there is always the question of what comes next. What life might lie beyond the life you've left behind? After Dave and I moved out of our apartment, I rented a brick studio near the gray flank of I-91. It was one long sunlit room directly above a middle-aged couple who filled their hallway with bulk boxes of mason jars. They were jammers. She had a long braid down her back, and he had staples on his scalp from an unmentioned procedure. Just after moving in, I gave them a plate of gingerbread cookies I'd made with a new set of cookie cutters shaped like forest animals: moose, squirrel, fox, purchased to signify the beginning of a new era of unwilled generosity and outward focus, in which I would always be doing little things for others. "Oh, that," I'd say, "that was nothing." I imagined the casual voice I'd use, the self-effacing tone of someone who wasn't doing anything for karmic credit. "No biggie, just baked you some foxes." I lived in that apartment for 18 months and used my cookie cutters once. The sharp, stinging thrill of my aloneness was like diving into an unheated pool. I told myself, "You'll adjust, you'll adjust, you'll adjust." All our furniture had been Dave's, so he let me keep the battered chairs we'd bought together from an Iowa thrift store, upholstered with vinyl roses. We'd been so excited to spot them on the thrift store sidewalk, so excited to buy something together. Now they sat on a hardwood floor in a room still waiting for a bed, a bookshelf, a table, anything. I was low on cash. Our landlady had kept our security deposit because we'd broken our lease. She said that maybe next time we'd think a little harder about living with somebody if we were going to break the lease after just 6 months. At my new place on Lion Street, I started spotting signs of mice, little droppings like BB pellets by the fridge, but didn't want to kill them, so I tried to banish them with mint extract, which I'd been told they hated. But they stuck around, savaging my foil pouches of cocoa mix into little shreds of tinsel. One died under my stove, something I realized only once I started to smell his rotting body under the unforgiving peppermint odor that had settled like a blanket over my whole life. Each morning at dawn, I sat on my kitchen counter and watched the cars surge north up I-91. The absence of booze tingled like a ghost limb. The specter of another life felt like someone breathing heavily nearby, another version of this breakup in which I drank myself senseless each night, weeping and blowing my nose into toilet paper, drunk dialing Dave after midnight to ask, "Who are you with right now?" I knew I wasn't supposed to want that other life. Unseemly, falling apart. But some part of me longed for it. In that life, I would make a fool of myself, and that foolishness would tell him how much I missed him better than anything else could. Instead, I was just pushing my yogurt around, dry-eyed. Every few weeks, a new jam, blackberry, rhubarb, red currant, showed up outside my door, sealed so tightly I could never open it. I ran the jars under water and smacked them against counters, then lied to my neighbors weekly about how much I loved their various jams on my morning toast. I started chairing the 7:30 meeting every Wednesday morning, trudging to that warm room through the bitter January cold. Whenever the court order folks came up to me afterward to get their cards signed, my first impulse was to direct them somewhere else, not because I didn't want to sign their cards, but because I didn't think I was qualified. "You should get someone more official," I wanted to say, but then realized I was as official as anyone. I still loved that early morning meeting. The voices of others still made me want to drop down on my knees in front of them, to thank them for letting me lose myself for a moment by listening to them. And there was also this guy in a maroon tracksuit who'd started looking at me from across the room. My psyche was hungry for sustenance, my outfits carefully chosen. "I don't care why you newcomers are here," said Theo, the group's anchoring old-timer. "You come because you want to get sober, or you come because you want the free coffee, or you come because you want to get laid. I don't fucking care. Just keep coming." The man across the room, whose name was Luke, told me that every morning before the meeting he walked his dog to the top of East Rock, a huge hill on the edge of town, to watch the sunrise. Did I want to join them sometime? I did. He texted 20 minutes before he picked me up, at 5:30 the next morning, to ask if I wanted milk or sugar in the coffee he was bringing me. We walked uphill, with snow on the ground, and flirted in the early cold, watching dawn spread like a murky juice over the industrial buildings of New Haven. I'd always wondered what sober dating would be like, and here it was. Nothing like dipping into the sweet buzz of wine over candlelight. It was walking uphill on a sludgy winter morning, with chapped lips and a mouth sour with the aftertaste of plain black coffee. Raw and unknown. Thrilling. In those days, acquaintances who wondered if they had a problem with their drinking often got drunk and pulled me aside to tell me about it. I was like a sober version of them, a hypothetical self they felt accountable to. One night, as I was leaving the Anchor, a dive bar that I still loved for its vinyl and fries, a woman rushed after me onto the sidewalk, holding a can of Sea Hag. She was a friend of a friend from grad school, often drunk at parties, and she told me she was getting scared by her blackouts. Had I gotten blackouts? Was that why I didn't drink? She'd noticed I didn't drink. And how had I stopped? And what was it like? I wrote her the next day. "A lot of what you said about drinking made sense to me. If you ever want to come to a meeting..." And then, ashamed of proselytizing, "No pressure at all." "Ha," she wrote back, "I don't even remember saying any of that." Through meetings, I became friends with a woman who'd been in the nurse anesthetist program at Yale New Haven Hospital. She'd been stealing opiates from work, and she'd accidentally overdosed in a hospital bathroom and gone into cardiac arrest. If you're going to go into cardiac arrest, a hospital bathroom isn't a bad place to do it, she told me over lunch one day. Just don't lock the door. When she described her stubborn desire to court that sweet blackness, I didn't feel pity or disgust. Part of me just craved the surrender. We finished our lentil soup, our green smoothies, our tiny bread loaves, icons of our wholesomeness, and then I went home and Googled, "What does dilaudid feel like?" and found a user forum thread called, "What's all the hype about?" A user called Swim talked about trying Dilaudid and counting to 10. At 7 seconds, it hit him like a wave, better than anything he'd ever experienced. But in the very next post, Swim said he couldn't understand why anyone